Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Everyone's heard of the Neanderthal men and women, I suppose, but most people are hazy on what and who they were. Even scientists, as far as I know relatively little about the Neanderthals. I think you can do 10 seconds of research and find out that they lived for nearly 200,000 years over a long span of time, in other words, and then suddenly disappeared around 28,000 years ago. So the big question is, what happened to them? You know, and also, are they related to us? You know, were they just kind of a dead end on the hominid tree or the primate tree that in general led to Homo sapiens, but they were kind of an offshoot of it that went nowhere? So we have an idea what they looked like from fossil remains, but not much else, as far as I know. My guest today, though, knows a lot more than we do about it. He is Professor Robert McCarthy, a professor of anthropology at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. And he has actually helped to fill in part of the mystery about what else we need to know about the Neanderthals, in particular, more recently, what they sounded like. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Why don't we start off just kind of giving a brief tutorial about the Neanderthals in general. Like, where did they live?
They lived in Europe and Asia, the western part of Asia, so places like Israel and Iraq and France and other places in Europe, both Western and Eastern Europe. They lived from about 200,000 years ago to, like you said, 28,000 to 30,000 years ago. They went extinct at about that time, and that's about the time when our own species, Homo sapiens, came into Europe and Asia. So they went extinct around the time that we came on the scene, basically.
So that's kind of a clue, I guess, that we only overlapped with them briefly. How many of their remains have been found?
Well, that's one of the most interesting things about them is that there are lots of remains, so plentiful remains, more so than any other hominid or early human species, you know, representing hundreds and hundreds of individuals over a large area. And so we really do know quite a lot about them. Unfortunately, what we have are the skeletons, the skulls, the hard tissues, and the archaeological remains from Neanderthals. So there are a finite set of questions that we can actually address about how they lived and, you know, what they looked like and that sort of thing. But my research, for instance, tries to address some of the things that in the past we haven't really been able to say too much about, such as what they might have sounded like or what they, you know, might have sounded like if they talked to each other or to early modern humans, our species.
Let me get to that in a minute, but I still want to kind of explore more about what they were like. I think that the name Neanderthal, as I recall, comes from like the Neander Valley in Germany, maybe? Is that where some of the first bones were found in a cave?
It does, yeah. The first skeleton to be recognized to be a Neanderthal is from Germany, from the Neander Valley. There were a couple that were found earlier than that, but they were thought to be just other odd types of modern humans. It wasn't clear that they were a separate type of thing, a separate species. But in the Neander Valley in Germany, these remains, it was clear that these were a different type of thing. And so for, you know, over 100 years, we've known that there's a separate species that existed in the world for, you know, coexisted with us for 150,000, 170,000 years.
So those of us who aren't anthropologists and so on probably hear over the years about the discovery of different, you know, kind of proto-human hominids or whatever. I mean, I remember Lucy and then Australopithecus. And so where do Neanderthals fall in kind of the family tree that led to man or in the sequence of hominids, I guess?
Well, the very, very, very last part of it. So the things you're talking about, Australopithecines, are from 3, 4, 5 million years ago.
Yeah.
So they're very early. Like if you saw one of those, you would immediately think of a chimpanzee.
Uh-huh.
They look almost exactly like chimpanzees, except they stood upright and they walked on two legs. But you would have thought that they were chimpanzees or a cousin of a chimpanzee bonobo that exists in the world nowadays. Neanderthals are very, very much more like us. So they were incredibly complex. They, you know, probably had a language, symbolism, you know, created types of art, hunted, lived in the types of groups that we lived in. And they're very close to us. They're basically our closest evolutionary cousin.
But, you know, the word Neanderthal in slang sometimes means, like, really dumb and backward. You know, he's a real Neanderthal.
It does, yeah. That's totally unfortunate because, you know, the fate of the Neanderthals, their popular image has sort of waned and waxed over the years. And I think now it's in a time where it's basically waxing, where we know that Neanderthals are these, you know, incredibly complex people that lived till 28,000, 30,000 years ago. But in the past, you know, people reconstructed them, researchers reconstructed them as being, like, stoop-shouldered and shuffling around and being violent. And that's really not the case. They buried their dead. You know, they're very complex.
So, I mean, how do we, that's what I was getting at, how do we know how their intelligence compares with us and that they were, you know, social, intelligent creatures other than, you just mentioned, they buried their dead?
Well, they buried their dead, yeah. So the only thing we have are these intriguing clues. So they buried their dead. That is one of them. There's some evidence that they might have put flowers in graves and things like that. So they might have had, you know, sort of funerary process. They lived in social groups together, and they actually took care of sick individuals. So there are Neanderthal skeletal remains of, you know, men with arms that had been injured or, you know, injuries to the head that they would have, you know, somebody needed to have taken care of those individuals for them to have survived.
But so they did.
We have these sort of clues that, you know, we can glean from what we have, the archaeology and the fossil remains.
But did they make tools? Did they build structures of any kind?
They did. They didn't. We're not so sure about building structures. That's one of the things that perhaps we can't really say too much about because we just have no evidence of it. But they lived in caves, and our early ancestors as well lived in caves, Homo sapiens. So around that time, if you're living in Europe, you're living in Western Asia, you know, the best place to live is in caves. It's, you know, it's good shelter.
Sure.
They could put, they made fires, you know, that sort of thing.
Withstands hurricanes better than ours do.
Yeah, probably. I don't know how many hurricanes are in Europe.
Not too many.
But no, so we know a little bit about them from those types of studies.
So you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Professor Robert McCarthy, an anthropologist at FAU, about Neanderthals, and we're getting to his research specifically that figured out how, at least in principle, what they think Neanderthal sounds, speech sounds, might have sounded like. But first, you know, we talked earlier about their disappearance overlapping, I mean, coming almost at the same time as the appearance of modern man, who, I guess, I don't know, is modern man Cro-Magnon man, or is that another precursor man?
It is. That's the name for a particular type of modern human from France, Cro-Magnon man from the Cro-Magnon caves. That's about 20 to 30,000 years old.
So what are the different theories about the disappearance of the Neanderthal then 28,000 years ago, which I guess is really just a blink of an eye in, you know, and certainly in geological history and even in paleontological or human history, I guess?
It is. So, you know, first of all, it should be said that they lived for an incredibly long time. 200
yeah.
to 28,000 years ago is a long time.
Mm.
And they were successful. So think about this, that they lived in caves at that time, but they lived at the time when it was basically an ice age.
Mm.
So they survived in Europe at a time when we could not have survived in Europe. Somehow they did it. They're incredibly cold adapted. They hunted almost exclusively. They hunted, you know, they ate meat as basically 100% of their daily diet, which is incredible. There's no modern human population that even comes close to that. That said, they also were different from us in many different ways. So they, like I said, they hunted a lot, which got them injured a lot. So their patterns of injuries are actually the same as modern rodeo riders.
Oh, is that right?
So they have lots of injuries that it's clear they were coming into a close contact with, you know, these large mammals, and, you know, they were hunting them with spears that they were thrusting into the animals, not throwing them.
So it was like hand-to-horn combat.
Right, exactly. So they lived an incredibly difficult life, and there's some evidence that they couldn't really change from that. They couldn't adapt to, you know, they never used bows and arrows. They kind of stayed with the same sort of technology over their entire span, and it probably didn't help when modern humans came on the scene in Europe and basically outcompeted them and was able to use better technologies to, you know, to hunt and to collect food. Another interesting thing is, so for instance, at the 28 to 30,000 year time span, Neanderthals were living near the ocean, yet they never made use of seafood, or they never fished. There's no fish bones at Neanderthal sites. There's no shellfish. So it's almost like they never thought to exploit that environment, which we exploited. And we, our early ancestors, come out of Africa 200, 150,000 years ago. And we bring this type of lifeway out of Africa where we're fishing, we're hunting with bows and arrows. It's a little bit more complex, and we're replacing the Neanderthals in Europe who are using this older type of lifestyle that's sort of a cold-adapted, you know, big-game hunting lifestyle. It just, you know, one idea then is that they, you know, they were basically out-competed by modern humans.
Well, they just weren't very adaptable or very flexible, and they were adapted to live in an ice age. When the ice age receded, they were kind of left high and dry maybe or something.
Right, yeah, maybe.
But, I mean, is there any chance they were just physically wiped out by a modern man and killed, you know, shot with arrows when they couldn't, they didn't have arrows, you know?
There is. It's intriguing, right? That would be interesting. That's interesting to think about. As of this date, there's no evidence for that.
We don't want to tell the Geico guys on the Geico commercial about that.
Right.
They'll
you know, when that first came out, I was wondering, are those Neanderthals? I guess they are, but I guess they could be Cro-Magnon.
I was going to ask you what you thought, actually.
I think they're Neanderthals.
Well, I think they're called cavemen, so that sort of implies, who knows. But
could be early members of our species as well.
Anyway, could be the Grateful Dead, too. But is there also a possibility that, could modern man have interbred with them? Were they physically the same species where they could interbreed?
Okay, that's an interesting point, because I'm giving you a modern viewpoint based on modern research in the last 10 years, when basically now we have, we're able to look at the DNA of Neanderthals, which is incredible. And it's clear from the DNA that they are not, they're closely related to us as cousins, but they probably didn't interbreed all that much. If they did, then, you know, it was a very minor component, and their DNA really doesn't survive in us. But previously, like, if you had asked me that question 30, 40 years ago, one valid answer would have been to say, well, Neanderthals, you know, yes, we are Neanderthals. You know, modern Europeans are Neanderthals, at least partially. But nowadays, our understanding is that they're close to us evolutionarily, but probably didn't interbreed with us all that much when we came into contact for that couple thousand years in Europe.
Huh. Well, even all that much, if that's true, would imply some, which would imply there's some mixing of gene pool there. And so, you know, the people with thick brows, who knows? But anyway, I won't get into that.
Right. I mean, we can make as many jokes as we want, but there's really no Neanderthal genes in modern.
Okay.
That's the point.
Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio with your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Rob McCarthy, a professor of anthropology at FAU. So what do you think your research most recently, and the thing that you kind of came into the national and international news a little while back about, is that you have been able to determine at least a theory or in principle what Neanderthals sounded like, which, of course, you can't do normally just from the fossil itself. So how did you do that?
Well, actually, we did use the fossil, but we're able basically to model what the sound, what the types of sounds coming out of a Neanderthal vocal tract would have sounded like. So we did a reconstruction of the vocal tract where, well, the incredibly difficult thing about the whole procedure is that your vocal tract, including your tongue, is made up of soft tissues largely. So these are tissues that don't make it to the fossil record.
Right.
So what we had to do is reconstruct the heads and necks of Neanderthals and try to fit different types of vocal tracts and tongues in there. And one really intriguing thing that we found is that Neanderthal had a head and neck that was proportioned in such a way that they couldn't have held a modern human-like vocal tract. So the horizontal part of their vocal tract, the part that's basically the tongue that you can see in your mouth, is much longer than the vertical part, the part that's back in the throat. And that's because they had incredibly long faces, longer than ours, and they had really short necks. And that hadn't really been appreciated to this point, that their necks were so short and their faces were so long that their vocal tract would have been shaped a little bit differently than ours is. And with that vocal tract, we're able to then to pass sound waves through to and use a speech synthesizer to model what the types of sounds that they were able to make sounded like.
Okay, so what do you think they sound like?
Well, we speak with these types of vowels called quantal vowels. The perfect example is like the vowel E in C. That vowel is something that a chimpanzee, for instance, can't produce, because chimpanzees also have these vocal tracts that aren't like ours because of their long faces. So they're not able to make the sound E. They can make a sound that's more like I. But the sound E and other sounds like A and U are incredibly important for our language, because our brain basically does this complex calculation and cues on those sounds, and those sounds help to improve the other sounds of our speech. So we're able to talk incredibly fast, at an incredibly fast rate, communicating lots and lots of ideas, you know, per second, per minute, per hour. And
especially if you're a teenage girl.
Exactly. And speech is one of the fastest things that we do. Hmm. And it's those quantal vowels that allow us to speak that fast and to speak that clearly with basically no error or little error. Okay. And Neanderthals would not have been able to produce those sounds. They wouldn't have had those sounds in their speech and in their language. And so their language would have been a little bit more error-prone, a little bit slower, and it would have sounded something like I instead of E. Like, they couldn't make that turn to that one sound and a couple other sounds.
So, I mean, they still have vowels. It's not just a bunch of guttural consonants, but...
No, right. They still... There's no doubt that they had... They communicated with each other in some way, that they had a language, probably a complex language, but it just wouldn't have been exactly like the language that we have. Wouldn't have been quite as efficient, let's say.
They didn't leave any cave paintings. That was even a more modern thing then, I guess, huh?
That is, yeah. The oldest cave paintings are about 31,000 years old, and those are in caves that are associated with modern humans.
Hmm. So all we have as far as sort of our hypothesis of how Neanderthals sounded is, so far, is your model. How did you derive it, and how did you come to be the first one to kind of think about this and do this? Is this something that's been bubbling away under the surface of Neanderthal studies for a long time?
Kind of. Actually, I teamed up with a linguist, Phil Lieberman, who had done previous reconstructions of Neanderthal vocal tracts and the vocal tracts of other types of humans. Other researchers have sort of looked at the vocal tract, but none have really reconstructed the neck plus the skull like we did. So we have these reconstructions, and it's kind of funny because Phil Lieberman, my colleague, has been doing this for 25 years or something like that. And I don't know why he never synthesized the speech sounds before, because it seems like the most obvious thing to do, to see exactly what, you know, he had said what the sounds might have sounded like before, but to actually hear the sounds, I think, is a pretty incredible thing, to hear exactly what these sounds might sound like. And in the future, what we want to do is reconstruct sentences and paragraphs. Now, of course, Neanderthals did not speak English or German or French or any modern language, but we want to construct a few sentences just to see what their speech might have sounded like with those sounds in it.
So how many different sounds have you been able to simulate so far? You gave us kind of an E or I or whatever it was sound, but how many?
Well, that one's, we've done a couple more after that, but really we've concentrated on the E to start, because that's really the most important vowel. I mean, linguists call that the super vowel.
Oh, really?
Because it's kind of hard to produce, and it's the most sort of human-like sound that we make. But now we're working on the other vowels and the consonants, and it's very difficult. Synthesizing speech is an incredibly, incredibly difficult. I didn't realize how difficult. You know, I'm a person who works on hominid evolution.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't realize what I was getting myself into when I started this.
You thought those linguists? Well, they just talk.
Oh yeah, they just put it all together. But if you listen to a computer speaking, you'll realize the difficulty. It has sort of that up and down, lilting, like, do you want to play a game?
Yeah.
Putting the sounds together.
Yeah, kind of robotic.
And linking them up is, it's very difficult, because if you say the sound E in C and in B, for instance, those two sounds are actually different, because as you go into the E and as you come out of the E, you're actually making slightly different sounds that if the sounds that you make aren't like an alphabet. They just can't be combined together into different words. They're actually slightly different. Speaking is incredibly complex.
Yeah, I never thought about that. The sound C is really, you know, of the letter C is really just an S and an E, right? It's more like the word C, I guess. But you'd think offhand that, or I would think offhand that that you could kind of put this model into a supercomputer and let it crunch away for an hour or so, and you could come up with a whole range of vocalization approximations or something, but it's not that easy, huh?
It's not, no. So we're using a synthesizer, which is really made for individual, individual sounds now, and we're actually trying to, to yoke those sounds together, partially manually and partially using these speech synthesizer programs, which is kind of interesting. But we'll get it done at some point. It will always have that sort of artificial computer quality to it, just because. That's really the state of the art in speech synthesis.
Is anybody else doing this at all that you know of?
I don't think so. So I know a couple people, particularly in France, are working on the reconstructions. I don't think on the I don't think on the speech synthesis now.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Professor Rob McCarthy, an anthropologist at FAU, about his studies with Neanderthal people, and in particular their vocalizations, or what he and a linguist colleague are constructing as being their vocalizations. So, well, what are you working on next, Rob?
Well, I'm still trying to, this will take, I think, about the next year.
Okay.
But, of course, I'm working on other things. I don't just work on Neanderthal speech. My specialty is actually the skull of Neanderthals and modern humans and other types of early humans, like you said, an Australopithecine and things like that. And so one of the things I do is I look at the relationships among those different species, early human species, using the size and shape of their skull. So that's something I'm currently working on. I also work on how the skull is put together, how it grows and develops.
Do you think there's a direct correlation between the size of skull and intelligence?
we're going to go for another hour from here, huh?
Well, we got a few minutes. go for it.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, really?
No. Well, I guess that answer was simple enough. But
yeah, it was.
But the size of, yeah, and this is something that has gotten lots of anthropologists in lots of trouble over, 100 years. But
well, there's nobody else listening. It's just you and me talking.
Right. But there's really no relationship between the size of the brain or skull and intelligence or IQ or whatever. People from Europe and Asia that tend to have larger body sizes tend to have bigger brain sizes. People from Africa might have smaller brain sizes associated with smaller body sizes. And really, everybody in the world's brain is scaled to their body size in some way. And so your brain is as big as it needs to be to control whatever your body, whatever size your body is. I myself have a very small brain. I'm sure there are other people elsewhere that have really, some people have brains that are 2,000 cubic centimeters, which is really gigantic.
But they don't have PhDs.
Maybe. Oliver Cromwell, for instance.
Really?
Had a huge head? 2,000 cubic centimeter brain. His head must have been gigantic.
Well, if the lungs were continuing in a jocular vein, I think kind of the rumor is that most actors have very large heads and small bodies, but I don't know if there's any relevance to that. But
that is very interesting, actually. Well, it's funny you say that, because that is actually something called neoteny, which is sort of like a juvenilization, so that they're that having a big head and a smaller body is more like an infant, right? And there's some research, whether or not it's crazy, I don't know, but there's some research that suggests that having a large head with like sort of childlike features on the face is actually preferred by men.
Preferred by men. I'm not sure how far to go into this, but anyway,
no.
By men to have for themselves or in other men or what?
Men prefer that in women.
Oh, okay, in women. Okay, that's what I was
going to say. So it would be like the sort of Christina Ricci face or whatever, right?
Yeah, so the big baby doll look or whatever.
Right.
I guess we like that.
Or Betty Boop, right?
Or something, yeah. So that's why I was afraid to get into this, because we get into socially, politically incorrect stuff.
No, of course. Yeah.
And all that jazz. But and I suspect that as long as we're on the topic, then it's a big factor is how much use you make of your brain, right? You can have a huge brain and ruin it in various ways, or just not use it,
and
a relatively small brain, and use it very adroitly, and get a whole lot farther with it, right? And it's also a matter of health and nutrition and opportunity and environment and all those things.
Right, so environment, especially early on,
sure,
during childhood and
sure,
the sorts of connections your brain make.
Right. What kind of influences your parents impose on you and all that. So,
exactly.
So obviously it's a real complex picture, but I thought maybe there was some general sort of correlation between, you know, order of magnitude changes in size of brain or whatever. But.
Oh, well, okay. if we bring it back to hominid evolution, yes. You know, a chimpanzee has a brain that's about 400 cubic centimeters. Our brain is about 1,350 cubic centimeters. And there are early human hominids between chimpanzees and modern humans that, you know, 2, 3, 4 million years ago that have intermediate-sized brains. So in some general large sense, there is a relationship between brain size and intelligence. In our own species, there's no relationship.
Yeah, okay. So maybe it's like the more a species evolves over millennia, then maybe the larger their brain tends to get or whatever.
Which, by the way, getting back to Neanderthals, the average Neanderthal brain size is 1,600 cubic centimeters, which is actually larger than our brain.
Oh, is that right?
Uh-huh. But they had bigger bodies as well.
Oh, okay. There you go. They probably had a lot of hair, which kept them warm in the Ice Age.
They undoubtedly did, yeah.
In fact, that reminds me, you know, we have just a couple minutes left, but I remember reading somewhere a long time back that during World War II, I think that some, you know, a detachment of German soldiers basically came on a farmer in the Siberian forest. This guy was living way out in, you know, far from anything, not even part of a village. And his wife basically to them looked like a Neanderthal. I mean, looked like a woman covered with hair and hunched over and, you know, not like a human. And, you know, he had a name for her. He'd been married to her. They had children. I mean, you know, whether they were married or not, anyway, they'd been living together for years. Have you ever heard that kind of story?
I never have. Now it's you talking about the politically incorrect story, huh?
No. Well, I'm relating something that at least I read as being a fact, but I couldn't begin to tell you where I read that.
No, I never heard that. No. You know, coverage of body hair over the body actually, you know, differs across the globe based on climate and environment.
Right, but I mean a dense pelt of hair, you know, like an animal, you know.
Well, no, so I never heard that.
Not just like the Italian grandma who needs to shave her up, or who needs a depilatory beyond that level.
Right.
Well, anyway, it's been interesting to talk with you about anthropology. Is that a field that's pretty popular these days? It was, I think, in the late 60s.
Yeah, it is. It is, especially now with modern genomics and, you know, genetic information. There's so much more we can address about, you know, variation in modern humans and even hominid evolution. So it is a popular field nowadays.
Well, again, thanks for being on. It's been interesting to talk with you about the Neanderthals, and we'll watch the news and maybe revisit it later when you come up with complete sentences that that Neanderthals might have spoken, like you know, could I have a McDonald's or something?
Right.
Anyway.
Okay, great. Well, it's good to talk to you.
You too, Robert. Thanks again. And thank you all for listening. Next week, we'll be talking with Dr. Jamie Ellis from the University of Florida about a topic that's had the internet buzzing over the past couple years. He's an expert on bees, and in particular, why they're rapidly disappearing all around the world. There's been a lot of speculation about what's causing the mysterious phenomenon of colony collapse. Is it pesticides, parasites, inbreeding, cell phones? Whatever the cause, it's starting to have major economic and environmental impacts. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.